3, 2, 1. Log Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Joe Cristiano, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Sunday evening, May 4th, 2008. It is now 8:01 p.m. Standard Daylight Time in the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Good evening, everyone. I'm Joe Cristiano. Welcome to Liberty Talk Radio. Our call-in number this evening is 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. You could also email your comments at any time to comments@libertytalkradio.com. I encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com. That's mytwocentsonline.com. Then that two is a numeric two. He discusses economic issues and how they affect you. He has a free bi-monthly, or I guess bi-weekly, newsletter that's online. Excellent. And he also has a subscription newsletter, which I do recommend that you subscribe to. It's only $39 or $49 a year. And it gives advice as to where to put your money these days. In these tumultuous times, folks, it is important to become informed. And Andy knows his bananas. I would also like to remind our listeners to subscribe to our reminder service by visiting our website and clicking on the subscribe icon. Good evening, everyone. This evening, we are pleased to have with us Mark B. Pickering. Mark's latest novel, Story of the Sand, describes the struggles veterans face when attempting to return to normalcy in American society. Based on many in-depth interviews with veterans from World War II, Vietnam, the Gulf War, and the current conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, we learned what the news media doesn't or could not report. Now, Mark will be calling in any moment now. I think I asked him to call in about 8:05, so he would not be holding on. Before he comes in, I had a little quip here from the Information Clearinghouse. This is where I got it from. And there's another very, very well, it'd be very well for you to subscribe to. It's free online, but they do ask for donations, small donations from time to time. And this is from Ambrose Bierce. And Ambrose says, the slightest acquaintance with history shows that powerful republics are the most warlike and unscrupulous of nations. Now, doesn't that bother you? Doesn't that bother you that, you know, people say things like that, and if you look around, you find that so much of what we're doing is empire and like, and it just is not the right thing to do. Wouldn't it be amazing if we closed all the bases around the world and strictly took a defensive stance with our military? Literally the trillions of dollars that we would save and the friends that we would make around the world, and we would become the economic powerhouse of the entire planet. And yet we don't do that, do we? No, we just keep on imposing ourselves around the world. And at the same time, imposing on our freedoms, so supposedly to protect us from all the bad guys. That cuts both ways, folks. All right, it's almost 8:05. We should have Mark calling in any moment now. This is interesting. Here he is right now. Let's see where he is. Good evening, Mark.
Hey, Joe.
Hello, Mark. Thank you so much. I just made your introduction. And thank you much for being part of our program this evening. We really appreciate it. We're honored to have you here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Your latest book, Story of the Sand, really intrigues me because I know very little about the plight of the veteran. And your book obviously describes that. Would you just tell our listeners something about yourself and how you arrived at writing this book, and if you had any previous books prior to this?
I have had no... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Are you saying something?
No, it's all yours.
Okay. I have. This is my first published book. I've written many, many books that have not been published, but this is my first published book. How I came to it is I very casually made the acquaintances, and it grew stronger inevitably with veterans from many different wars, from World War II to Vietnam to the Gulf War to the current Iraqi and Afghanistan conflict, and you know, all the stories that I heard from them really grew weight in me, and I am a fiction writer, and inevitably when I when I'm inspired to do a book, it's always going to be, you know, from the perspective of made up characters, and all their stories really grew a weight in me, and I saw this guy walking into a bar with a prosthetic leg, and he was younger.
Mark, are you still there? Mark, have we lost you? Folks, I think we just lost our line. He still shows that he's on the line, but we lost the audio. Mark, are you there? Boy, this never happened before. This is an all-time first. All right, we'll just wait a moment. Maybe he'll call back. Mark, you're back.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Was that on your end or our end? Do you know? You have any idea?
I think it was your end. I heard just some very loud noise, and then that was it.
Okay, because I heard nothing on this end other than everything went blank. But your number was still on our screen. Okay, well, let's continue. If it's on our end, I sincerely apologize. That's never happened before.
No. Fine. But anyway, I saw this guy walking into a bar with a prosthetic leg, and that immediately triggered me to want to write this story. And again, it's a fictional story, and it surrounds the characters of Samson Roy, who is he suffers from severe post-traumatic stress disorder, and he comes back from Iraq, and he inevitably sequesters himself in the woods for 9 months. And the ghost of David Tree comes to visit him, and David died after he lost his leg in Iraq, and he died from an infection back at home. And so I wanted to show the dichotomy there of a soldier that is still alive and kind of wishes he wasn't, and a soldier that has died and really wishes, you know, to be back in life.
Right. Now, your book is a novel, but everything that you bring to the novel is based on actual interviews and personal experience with the veterans. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean... I want to make sure that people understand that I am not retelling any stories. Their emotions are heavily injected into the novel, but the actual story is my own making, and it's me sort of taking components. And this is a very very inadvertent thing that I do. It's taking components from the stories that I heard from, you know, wives and girlfriends not being able to relate to the husbands who return home, and since I only spoke to men, it's on that end. Even though now we have women in the Army, but although I do have some women in the book as well that are in the Army, in the military, but all in all, it is a novel. It is my own reimagination of these lives in a very extreme form.
Did you experience a difference between the among, I should say, because we're talking about more than two, but the veterans of, I guess there were very few World War II veterans because they
yeah,
were really old, very few, right? But I'm sure there was a large group of Vietnam and Gulf War veterans. What was the difference in what you heard from each one, or was really each one parroting the other in what they experienced?
I would say the only difference is that the World War II veterans, you know, when they came home, it was a whole other thing than when the Vietnam veterans came home.
Right. I have friends who are Vietnam veterans, and they talk about is how poorly they were treated when they came home.
Yeah, unfortunately, they were treated very poorly, and the World War II veterans weren't. But at the same time, you know, the wounds of battle, psychological and otherwise, are not any different. I mean, in some ways, for some of the World War II veterans, it was kind of even harder to be celebrated all the time, you know, especially after a while when they'd been through so much and the scars of battle, you know, remain with them. That, you know, they kind of, or at least some of the guys I spoke to, they kind of thought it was a little odd because, you know, it's not that they didn't want to be honored or respected, but they also didn't want war to be looked at as some fun thing, you know. And the people in Vietnam, it was a little more cut and dry that way, where, you know, I mean, war was difficult, and returning home was difficult, which doesn't make it any easier for them, actually makes it a lot harder for them. But, you know, war is war, and war from the beginning of time till the end, till whenever it ends, is never a glorious thing, as we're led to believe in certain novels and certain movies and whatever. And this is one thing they wanted to impart to me, and one thing I really felt with a lot of the stories they told me, especially in returning home and trying to acclimate back into a normal world where violence is not an everyday thing. And for some of them, it became an everyday thing because it became such a part of their DNA, so to speak. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm just agreeing with you. I'm just, yes. Do any one group appear to be more bitter than the other group because of the way things turned out, I guess, for them?
Well, you know, time will tell, even with the Gulf War veterans, and especially the Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans of the current. But the Vietnam vets, yeah. I mean, there was, I still see a guy who, when I talk to him, he's fairly lucid, but he's back on the streets now, and he's off his medication, and he's abusing one or more substances, and he doesn't even remember me anymore. And, you know, but unfortunately, I think that's going to include the Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans as well, inevitably, because as we all know, or maybe you don't, I would assume you do, but 25% of our homeless are veterans, and we're already seeing an increase of Iraqi veterans on the streets. And, you know, with a war such as this, which is unpopular, which has been kind of confusing, which is muddled in its understanding of its outcome, you know, the veterans, they reassess their lives and everything they went through and everything they saw, and they're seeing their buddies killed and having to kill people, and it becomes a very difficult thing compared to the World War II veterans, where, you know, that was the quote-unquote good war.
Right.
You know, and so, you know, they're older now, though, of course. I didn't speak to them when they were, you know, in their 30s and 40s. You know, they're a lot older than that. So they've had, you know, the ones that still remain have had time to kind of let it digest and kind of find reflection to it, where a lot of the guys in Vietnam and certainly the current Iraqi and Afghanistan conflict, it's a little more fresh, a little more raw.
Yeah. Were the Gulf War veterans any different than those that you've interviewed regarding the current conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan? Did you see much of a difference? That I
Yeah, they're a little different because that war was fairly quick, and I mean, I didn't speak to a large number of Gulfport. I spoke to a few, and I mean, you know, they have their own stories as well. You know, one guy told me about having to, you know, ambush a cave, and just the memories of what he had to do there, where he had to kill a guy, was still quite fresh to him. Anytime you do something like that, anytime you do something that dramatic, and unless you're a psychopath, it stays with you no matter what. I mean, they knew they had to do that. It was kill or be killed, but still, that's a difficult thing. And this is what I try to impart in my novel, Story of the Sand, where these people kind of, they went to war, especially Samson Roy, my main character. He goes to war with this feeling of euphoria, and he comes back a totally different man, and he doesn't know who he is anymore. And I'm not saying these guys I spoke to are exactly the same, but I was trying to show this.
Right.
These extremes.
Now, was there a common thread amongst all of these veterans which sort of tipped the scales and changed them? I mean, was there an incident? Is it killing the first person? Was it seeing the fellow soldier being killed? Was there any particular incident that was the most dramatic, that had the most impact psychologically on them?
You know, they all talk about the ones that did kill people. They all, you know, say, yeah, that was quite jarring, for the most part. In some cases, it's such a blur that it's some of them don't even remember their first kill. I hate to put it in that way, but
that's interesting.
But you know, because it was such a firefight or what have you, especially in something like Vietnam or you know, the Gulf War, when people were, or the current Iraqi War, where you know, just things are just happening and you're just kind of trying to stay out of death.
Yeah.
That but you know, I really tried to focus more so on how they acclimated into that life and how they had to come back into America, into you know, in my novel Story of the Sand, where they have to try and readjust to another life where they were required to be a wholly different person, and how it made them sort of reexamine who they really were. And war will do that. You know, war, I've not been in war, but in the stories that I've heard, you know, you will never, ever be the same when you come back from war. And everything you relate in life, it relates back to your experience in the most, you know, desperate and vile of times, which is what war is.
Yeah.
And that's what I really wanted to examine, and what just inevitably I examined because of the stories from guys that had come back, and I was here, and they were telling me more so, they talked a lot more to me about trying to fit back into society, where even when society was honoring them, they still, a lot of them felt so alien to what they once were.
The story of the title, Story of the Sand, how did you arrive at that?
Sand.
Story of the Sand.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, you know, because of the conflict being in the Middle East.
Oh, okay, I see.
Yeah, I mean, people could see all sorts of things in that, and
okay.
They're welcome to.
Okay, but, I don't know why I didn't make that connection. I feel stupid now.
No.
Did they feel bitter or about... the perception that was, their perception of war, or the perception of what they were going to do versus the reality, were any of them bitter because of that? Did they hold any animosity towards government? Were they disappointed in their government? How did they feel about that?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them are disappointed in their government. I mean, there's no question about that, and that mostly because of when they return home, which I try to address in my novel. You know, a lot of them are kind of forgotten. I mean, of course, the services are there and what have you, but it's the infrastructure is really not in place for the amount of men and women coming back with
right.
Not only mental issues but physical issues, and there's certainly a lot of bitterness there. But as far as your question about going, you know, I try, and one of my main characters, Samson Roy, he has this gung-ho father who's never been to war, and he's, ever since Samson could talk, his father basically was telling him, you're going to be a soldier, and when the next war comes, you're going to be in it. And I would see, men like that. I mean, men who had fathers who sort of wanted to be in the military, but either they couldn't or there wasn't a war, and they may have been in the military, but they never saw combat, and they made it out to be this rite of passage.
Right.
And when people went through it, they realized that, of course, look, I want to make it clear that I know occasionally war is sometimes necessary, unfortunately, but it is not some, and this is one thing, it's not some necessarily growing experience. It's not necessarily an experience that reduces you. It could be either or, but it's such a dramatic thing. And with Samson Roy, he came back feeling incredibly bitter, not only towards his father, but towards the government. And he drowned himself in liquor for so long and sequestered himself in the woods to try and stay away from anyone. And you would hear stories like that, not exactly the same, but certainly alcohol abuse, drug abuse, is, I heard many, many times. And, that's not incredibly strange. I mean, I talked to so many of these guys and so many other people I know that know veterans, not only from Vietnam and from this war and the Gulf War, that's something, bar fights happen more, altercations, it's just, you become a different person, and trying to acclimate back into a world you don't necessarily understand anymore makes you even more confused. And there's not necessarily the government infrastructure in place to try and bring you back, which I'm not saying is easy, but you probably have heard this, and they've tried to cover up lately just the suicides of veterans,
right,
from the current war.
My wife's an audiologist, and many of her patients are older people, and some of them, she said, served either in Korea or some World War II, and They're proud that they served, and they'll mention that their son served in Vietnam, and their grandchildren are now going to serve in, let's say, Iraq. And what I don't understand, when they have that type of mentality, it's almost as if they participated in a totally antiseptic war. Hold on, we have a caller in here.
Oh, we do.
Yeah, caller, your first name, where you're calling from, and your question, please.
Hello there. My name is Steve. I'm in Kansas City, Missouri. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to make a comment and say that sounds like Mark really spent quite a bit of time on his research, and sounds like he really, even though his story is fiction, that he really pegged it real well. I'm a 100% disabled veteran from the Vietnam War with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I have a lot of friends who are in the same boat that I'm in, but from what you described, it sounds like you understood what you saw and the people you talk to.
Well, I appreciate that. I certainly hope I did, and I want to thank you for your service, sir. And I hope you're, getting whatever help you can. And I hope that I know the government isn't the greatest at that, but I really want to tell you I appreciate your service to our country.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve, for calling in. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
All right. So long.
Thank you.
Well, that was interesting.
That
was nice to hear from someone. Yeah, it seems to there seems to be a void somewhere. Here we have an event. The war is an event, if you will, And it's an ugly event. It's something that, when you think about it, no one in their right mind would voluntarily do. Yet we have people enlisting to participate in this event without even giving it any analysis, thinking to themselves, well, geez, what will this cost me? What's the probability of something going right, wrong, or indifferent? It seems that people go into this. By the way, Steve, are you still on the line? No, he's still on the line. Okay. It seems that people, the young men and women, go into this thing totally blind. What are they thinking about? It's almost like saying, well, I want to become a chemist, and I know nothing about chemistry whatsoever, but I want to become a chemist, and I'll be damned if I'm going to even look into what chemistry is first of all. I mean, it's a totally irrational response as far as I'm... Now, if we are truly defending ourselves, everyone picks up their gun and they shoot and they do whatever they have to do. But to go halfway around the world to fight an occupation of another country, did any of these soldiers know what they were getting into?
You know, also you got to understand, there's a couple different reasons why people join the military. One is because they want to be in the military, their family's been in the military, again, it goes to the cultural thing, the family thing. But two, a lot of them want out of their situation, and this is why you see a lot of the people that go in the military, and I'm not saying at all like this, and it's not that it's wrong or not, but you know, a lot of the more urban or the more rural population of young men and women, because they want an out. They want to get out of what they see as a dead end. And so the military is an option, and the military looks for those candidates. And again, I'm not saying the military is desperate or whatever, but I'm saying there's a few reasons people go in the military, and you know, you're going to see, that's why you see a lot of these men and women, they're from the rural areas of America, or they're from the urban areas of America. You see very few from Beverly Hills and, you know, wherever, because they're looking for a way out, and they're looking for a career,
right,
where, you know, they don't have to be, you know, fast food or what have you. And again, I'm not trying to denigrate at all, but there are two different classes. There's the family history, and then there's this is my exit. And
right,
that's what happens, and they do what they got to do. And I talk to both. You know, I talk to men and men who you know, kind of didn't know what they wanted to do with their lives, and this was from all areas of the wars. And then men who, you know, their father was in the war, their grandfather was in the war, or their father wanted to be in the military and something was wrong with him so he couldn't, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many different reasons why. Probably right after 9/11, you're going to see, you know, more people trying to go, you know, signing up because they want to, you know, fight against whoever hurt us. Nowadays, I'd say it's one of the two I just mentioned. You know, either their family, it's always been in their DNA, or they want to get out of their situation. And even if it means perhaps threatening a limb or a life, they still see that as a better solution than to what they see their future as.
When you interviewed these veterans, did any of them indicate that they actually knew what they were getting into, or did they indicate in a sense that, we know people die in war, but it ain't going to be me, it's going to be somebody else?
Yeah, they rationalize. I mean, you know, of course you rationalize. Or maybe they think it will be them, but they don't really think about what that means until there is people dying around them. You know, you really don't know what that's like until you're there.
Right.
And if you've already convinced yourself you need to go, and especially in the case of Vietnam, not all of them wanted to go. They were drafted. So, you know, if in this current situation, if you're like, well, this is what I have to do whatever I have to do, you don't really dwell on it. It's like anything. You know, if you have to do something extreme and you think you have to do something extreme, you don't see to the extent you and I may see it where we don't have to or don't think we have to.
Right.
So, it's like anything in human experience, you rationalize whatever you're about to do, and then you really, until you're in the middle of it, you don't really know what it's going to be like until you're there. And that's when things really start to hit them. And again, you know, some of these guys are fine. Some of these guys are lawyers and doctors now, and, you know, they have families. And then the other side of it are guys who are on the street, still live with their parents. The guys from Vietnam still live with their parents, some of them. The guy I told you about on the street was living with his parents, and apparently he's not now. And, you know, it's like everyone is different, and war affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. And that's what I try to do in my novel, Story of the Sand, where I show Samson Roy, who's a completely broken man, and David Tree, who has died, but he was so happy to be home. And he really just was so happy to be home with his wife and his child. And he dies, and he wants to convince Samson back into the world. And
yeah,
that is his mission. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. No, I'm just agreeing. I'm just concurring with you, that's all.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. It affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally.
Yeah. How did you go about developing the questions? I'm sure the questions were set up in a certain fashion so everyone would ask the same questions and it wouldn't be random.
No.
It was not that way.
I'm sorry.
I say it was not that way. Actually, it was random in a sense, or however it worked out.
Yeah, no, I just got to know these guys. I mean, like I said, it was very casual. I had no intention of meeting these guys. I had no intention of writing about this in the beginning. I've always been a writer, but I never really know what I'm going to write about. And I just kind of got to know these guys in bars and restaurants, friends of friends, whatever. And they accumulated and they accumulated and they accumulated. And then, of course, when the Iraq war started, you know, people wanted to talk more. And, you know, I just would listen. I just listen to people. And I'm just a curious person. So if someone has gone through something so dramatic and such a different experience than mine, then I want to know about it. And
okay.
I have a way of getting people to tell me things that they don't tell everyone. I just do. I just have a way. And so I just would listen. And I had I just was interested. I just was curious. It was not for the reason of writing a book. And even when I started writing the book and I would see these guys and tell them about it, you know, they want to make sure, look, don't tell them my story or whatever. That's private. And I would tell them, I don't do that. You know, I write fiction.
Right.
I wouldn't even know how to do that. It's just not my way. So it's just, I just told them they are an inspiration, but I'm not retelling any of their stories.
Were any of them reluctant to speak to you at all, or were they pretty open?
In the beginning, they might have been, but again, you know, as I got to know them,
okay.
You know, and they knew that I had no real agenda, and I didn't. I had no idea about this. It just was something that I thought I had to write about. It just really concerned me, not only, you know, talking to them, but watching it on the news and you know, seeing how it's an afterthought when they leave the battlefield. That really
right.
kind of bothered me. It did bother me that, you know, these men and women, they put their lives in, I don't care if they're poor or uneducated or you know, not up from a family that anyone knows about. It doesn't matter. You know, they've done something very few of us will ever do or ever want to do, and they deserve the care and
right.
the treatment when they come back. To the utmost, you know, if we want to talk about national health care, let's start with them, where supposedly they have it, but we see all these holes.
Right.
And we're the richest country in the world, and we can't take care of our veterans. I mean,
right.
That to me seems yeah. very strange.
Mark, just let me take a second out for station identification, folks. This is Liberty
right.
Talk Radio. I'm Joe Cristiano, your host. Please call in 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. We have, as our guest, Mark B. Pickering, who is the author of Story of the Sand. He describes struggles veterans are facing in attempting to return to normalcy in American society. Mark, our news media appears to be dropping the ball, as they normally do.
Yeah.
I think the news media today, I'm becoming conspiratorial. I always complained about all these conspiracy theories, and I think I'm sounding like them now, because issues that the news media is supposed to be independent, supposed to be reporting to the public as to what's really going on. They're our safety valve, and yet they never mention anything but the slightest, the smallest hint that there are veterans around. And it would seem to me that if the news media gave the plight of the veterans just due, the armed forces would have a tremendously difficult time attracting anyone to get in there.
That's true. The media, I mean, you know, I'm not in the media, but, you know, I think there's a few reasons for that. I think, I think the whole thing was something that's happening right now and something that people in America don't feel like they can control. I think the media thinks, oh, it's going to be a downer talking about this or whatever. People don't want to hear about that. You know, you see all these movies that have come out about the Iraq War. None of them make any money. I mean, because, you know, I think it's because they're not only promoted, they're not very well promoted, but I think it's so ever-present that, you know, the American public, and, you know, perhaps it's the American public, perhaps it's the media, perhaps it's a combination of both, but they're like, I don't want to deal with that. You know, I hear about Iraq all the time, and, yeah, there's an explosion and whatever and whatever, and there's like a malaise now. And I think that's true in the media side as well, where there's just this malaise of, you know, we're just so tired of it. And that does them a disservice. It does our veterans a disservice.
Right.
And we keep saying, support the troops, and we put it on our bumper sticker and everything, but we don't want to hear about it.
That's right.
We don't
yeah.
want to know exactly yeah. what they've gone through and what yeah. they're going through here.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's just, it doesn't work that way.
Why do you think there are not more protests against the war as there were in prior wars?
Again, I'm sorry, say it again.
Prior wars where there were protests in the
streets.
Well,
there was a huge, you know, whenever we were going to war, and certainly in the beginning, you know, there were a lot of protests. I think right now, again, I think it goes to the malaise. We're just kind of waiting for Bush to leave.
Yeah.
And then we figure, oh, the next person might fix it or might not.
Okay.
We don't know and
yeah.
whatever, but again, I think it's just this malaise. I think
yeah.
it's this, you know, people eventually get tired of a cause, and that's unfortunate, you know. And again, I'm not necessarily for, I personally was against the war only because we were going in unilaterally. I didn't, you know, I actually, you know, I'm sorry to say this, but I actually believed Bush when he said there was weapons of mass destruction there, but I was against it because I didn't want us to go in alone. And, you know, but, you know, the thing is, I'm more concerned about right now about, you know, how the troops are handled there and over here, and especially when they leave, you know. And I think people just, you know, it's so raw that people don't, a lot of people just don't know how to handle it, or they don't want to handle it. You know, we're in a sphere, we're in a rarefied air in America, where we don't see dramatic things every day. Even if you live in the big city, I mean, I know you see some horrible things, you see some very desperate people, but it's not the same as, you know, going to Iraq or what have you and seeing what's going on there. So therefore, we sort of like to stay in our bubble. No matter how liberal or conservative you are, we like to kind of avoid that discomfort. And even if it's our men and women, you know, we say we support them, but we don't want to know exactly right. what's going on, because it's trying, you know. And that's unfortunate, but I unfortunately think that's true, especially now. Maybe in 5-10 years we'll want to examine it more, but something that happens, that's happening right now so intensely, I think that people sort of are so overpowered by it that they shut it off.
Yeah, you know, they make a big deal about the homeless, but what they don't ever mention is that the homeless, a good percentage of the homeless is comprised of veterans. I never heard that before.
Yeah, 25%. 25%.
Yeah, I never heard that before. Now, it doesn't surprise me at all, but I never thought of it. And there seems to be a cover-up. Like, let's not tell them anything about veterans because it may look... It'll reflect poorly on our government or someone. And I guess they have more difficult time. You know, it's almost like a recruiting office said, come in, you know, come to work. And when you arrive home, if you arrive home alive, most likely you'll wind up on the streets. I mean, it doesn't bode well.
Or we won't really pay attention to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear that time and time again. I'm sure your caller would concur with that, because that's what I would hear. And I've talked to many people, not only, you know, before I wrote the book, but after I wrote the book, I've talked to a lot of people saying the same things to me. You know, some guy is waiting for his disability after 3 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, these kind of things are, you know, this is just not forgivable for a country that's so pro-military. Well, if we're pro-military, then we should be pro-military health afterwards.
Right.
And they, you know, and again, I think this goes back to the whole they're disposable. I think I'm not going to say what their motives are or whatever, but all right, you go fight, go do what you got to do. When you can't fight anymore, well, we'll figure it out or we won't, you know,
yeah.
And that's just, you know, you're not going to get a lot of volunteers whenever, you know, when this really comes to light, not only from Vietnam, but from this too, and it will. I mean, you can't stop it. Inevitably, people will hear the stories, no matter how overwhelmed they are now. This is gonna be a huge thing for the rest of my life,
right?
For the rest of your life, for the rest of people 10 years younger than me or whatever.
Yes, absolutely.
Iraq is a big deal, and what we did there, and how we're treating our soldiers when they return home, that's not gonna go away.
Right.
It's not gonna go away.
Well, isn't the Office of Veterans Affairs and the VA hospitals, aren't they sort of stretched to the limit right now?
That goes to the whole problem of, you know, whenever you plan a war, you got to plan what happens after the war.
Right, right.
You got to plan not only what happens to the country, but you have to plan what happens to the people who return home. I mean, you know, this is the whole basis of, you know, planning a quick war. You know, and with rose-colored glasses, thinking everything's going to be wonderful and no one's going to get hurt and whatever. That's not what happens in war. That never happens in war. You know, even Colin Powell said this. You go in with a huge amount of force, and you make sure you have the resources available, you know, when there are injuries and what have you. And I don't think that happened, at least in this instance. And, you know, and we're going to be paying the price. I mean, not only financially, but millions of, not millions necessarily, but hundreds of thousands of men and women who are not only physically scarred, but mentally scarred, and that doesn't go away.
Yeah.
It doesn't go away in 10, 20 years, and it rarely goes away in a lifetime.
Yeah. Did any of the veterans mention, praise the type of help that they were getting from the VA? Did they consider it adequate or inadequate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do not want to downplay the VA workers. You know, it's not their fault.
Oh, I know. I agree with you. I mean, right. it's not a person in there saying, well, here's a soldier, screw him. I know that. I mean,
right.
they're trying to do their job, but if there's 10 soldiers and they can only help one, they can only help one, you know. But I didn't
right.
know. Is that the case or what? I mean, what?
Yeah, they're doing what they can. The thing is, when you become so overloaded, no matter who you are, you do get a little, and I don't mean to use this word in the worst way, but you do get a little calloused.
Right. No, I can understand that.
You know, yeah, when you see tens and twenties and thirties of men every day, it's like eventually you can't give that kind of personal care
right.
That you would if you saw one or two or three or whatever.
Yeah.
And you know that goes back to the funding. For the VA and for the VA professionals, and especially for the post-traumatic wing, which has been, again, like I say, lately, you know, there's been memos going around to downplay the suicides and whatever and
right.
pretend like it didn't happen. You know, that doesn't work. I mean, you can pretend all you want. They're going to continue
right.
to happen unless
yeah.
you deal with it.
Yeah. Did you come up with any conclusions as to how to fix the problem that we have now or what we should be doing differently? I mean, other than, you know, spending
more
money.
Generally, when I write a novel, I don't, you know, I think that perhaps I look at the world in a more idealized way or the way I'd like to see the world.
Yeah.
So it's not simple. I mean, I know it's not simple. Whenever you have such a huge military, people are going to fall through the cracks. It's going to happen.
Right.
But I think, in my opinion, and with this novel, Story of the Sand, what I try to focus mostly on is the stigma that the military has towards mental illness. And I think if we, as a society, try and pressure the military to accept mental illness and post-traumatic stress disorder as part of the process, which it's been forever, but it's not been accepted. You know, you'll still hear guys, and you can see it in any documentary, and you can see it with the guys I talked to from Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, they'll tell you, so many of their commanders are like, well, get over, you know, whenever you have these difficulties, get over it, you know, come on, be a man.
Right.
And that's ridiculous. And so I think where I focused on, because you can't, I can't solve the whole thing in a 220-page novel, but, you know, is the stigma of mental illness in the military is still a great, is a strong one. And the culture of that depression, that post-traumatic stress disorder or being in battle and being shell-shocked or what have you, whatever you want to call it, that's still a difficulty in the military to convey to your commanders, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and that's, at this point in our existence as humans, I think that's ridiculous. That's going to happen. You see your friends die. You see civilians die. You, even when you see the enemy die. I'm not saying you're going to be sad necessarily, but that's going to change you, and your mind is trying to figure it out. And it doesn't always, and usually doesn't, immediately write itself into some understanding of that.
Yeah.
That's an incredible thing to go through.
I saw a documentary about the World War I when the French were inducing people to go into war at that time. And, of course, no one was volunteering, and there was a very large number of people who were leaving after they signed up, basically, I guess is the nice way of putting it, you know. And in this documentary, they showed these beautiful girls singing songs about the France and, you know, and the soldier and, you know, how – you know, brave they were, and this inducing them to, and they it worked, and tens of thousands of soldiers signed up, and went to war and got killed. You know, but they couldn't get anybody, and they had to put on this big show. I mean, it was a big promotion, and it was a very, very successful promotion of these beautiful girls singing about the glory of war, basically, and that actually induced men to sign up by the tens of thousands.
I mean, of course, you know, you a lot of these guys look at as machismo, and like my character Samson Roy, he tries to woo who would be his wife with, oh, I'm going over there to kill the enemy, and she's not into it at all, and her name is Mary, and she's actually quite different from Samson. Anyone who wants to read the book will see that dichotomy. But, yeah, I mean, that's still a big part of it. I mean, you know, that's still a big part of it is the machismo, the feeling that you're going to be a man, that it's a rite of passage. And, you know, that's up to debate. It's not, I mean, I'm not going to tell someone not to join the military because I think that's a stupid reason why. You know, they can do whatever they want to do. But certainly that is a temptation, and that is one of the big reasons. That happens, and it will probably continue to happen depending on the environment. I'd say right now that's probably less of a probability, but 10, 20 years, who knows?
You know, a very, very close friend of mine is a Vietnam vet. He was a paratrooper. I mean, jumped out of airplanes beyond, I mean, this is heavy-duty stuff. And I asked him, I said, why did you do that? And he said, you know, when you're young, and, you know, all your friends are macho. And he's an intelligent guy, very well read. I mean, he's a sharp guy, you know. In fact, he's retired now, and he's doing very well for himself. But he said, when you're young and, you know, your friends are doing it, and geez, if they can jump out of a plane, I can jump out of a plane, you know. And he said, and there I am. I says, I'm in training camp and I'm jumping off these towers. I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing? Yeah, of course, it's too late at that point. You can't turn around and say, excuse me, I don't think I want to do this.
Right.
Well, no, he broke a lot of bones. He has injuries today that affect him today that he received, you know, jumping out of airplanes. And then he became an interrogator, and he actually learned to speak Vietnamese, and was an interrogator. And he said it was the most horrible thing he's ever done before. I mean, the whole war was horrible. You know, the way he says sometimes he was more afraid of his fellow soldier than he was of the Viet Cong. He says no one was sane, you know. And if people can only listen to him speak, I think maybe we would. Maybe if the government knew fewer people would go to war, they wouldn't get involved in these wars. They'd find an alternative out of these things, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think what you're seeing is the fact that, you know, the casualty rates are becoming less and less tolerable.
Yeah.
I mean, in Vietnam, I mean, you know, the Iraq War, I think we're over 4,000 now.
Yeah.
And that is nothing compared to Vietnam.
Yeah, Vietnam was 50,000?
Yeah, it was something like that. And and then, of course, you know, World War II was 600,000. And I think you're seeing that where we're not really understanding why so many people have to die anymore for, you know, these difficulties.
Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally people will. But just with us being so upset about that I think, you know, in a weird sort of way, that's a good sign that, you know, the unless it's an extreme case like I think Afghanistan was, you know, I think that was the right thing to do. I think to go into Afghanistan and get rid of the Taliban and harboring, you know, that was a terrorist state and they were threatening us. But unless it's that, you know, these other things that we do are not as acceptable. And I think that the more we grow as a nation, and I think that we realize that more and more. But still, I still give, and I know you know this, and I know you're not saying anything different, but I still give a lot of credit to the people that do decide to go and put their life on the line.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
99% of them are great, and they're incredibly heroic, and they've done things they had to do for their fellow soldier and for the civilians that, you know, I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, I can't imagine some of these soldiers who come home for the third and fourth time and have to return, leaving their families again.
But they do so because they don't want to let their buddies down.
Right,
that's a big deal.
That's right. It is that is the big deal, right. Now, did the veterans feel that their government misled them at all?
It depends who you talk to. I don't know about misled them. I mean, I spoke to these guys, almost all these guys after they came back, and I think they felt they were misled as how they would be taken care of when they returned.
Okay.
You know, of course, the war is debatable, but when you're over there, you do what you got to do.
Right.
You get your orders, and you do what you got to do.
Right.
But it was mostly their bitterness was towards, you know, believing that they were going to be taken care of from, you know, from the time they got home to the time, you know, they're in the old folks' home. And you know, sure, I guess it's a possibility, but there's so much hoops you have to jump through. And for some of these guys that I spoke to, and for like someone like Samson Roy in my novel Story of the Sand, that's not someone who's going to be calling the VA every day to figure out when his appointment is, because he can barely get out of bed.
Yeah,
and these kind of things, of course, go back to the family and all that. I understand, but also there has to be more proactive participation by the professionals to make sure these people get help.
Yeah,
and that doesn't happen, you know, a lot.
Yeah. Well, from all of the interviews, if you had to summarize, what did you take away in general from all these interviews? What was the overriding theme?
I really became very humbled because of feeling so sort of lucky in that I've never been through what they've been through, but I felt being a writer and being someone who is more attracted to darker material and explaining it and trying to figure it out on my own. I've been through my own dark stuff as well, but nothing like they've been through. But I got the understanding of how, you know, sort of precarious the mental state can be and how life can be and how things that we see as sunny and shiny in the eyes of someone who's been through so much brutality can be still this dismal reality that where, you know, they need to be helped along back into seeing the world, you know, the way they used to or try to. They're always going to have a different perspective, but that's what I was interested in this perspective of someone who comes from the safety, the warm safety of America, and then they go to this horrible situation in such a brutal area of the world, and they're thrust back into America. And it was just to me that situation of trying to acclimate and trying to, explain to their family or try and understand their family and loved ones, and that just really touched me. So that's why I wrote Story of the Sand, you know, just something that I had to write.
Well, you know, we talked about the soldiers themselves, but the families are impacted almost as strongly, right? And can you tell us something about that, about the families?
Well, again, you know, you would have wives and girlfriends who, you know, when the soldier came back, they didn't know how to deal with them. And some of them would leave, and some of them wouldn't, and those are the more courageous ones, obviously. But, you know, and they had to kind of push, and you'd hear this from these guys, they would have to push them, you've got to go to your appointment, you got to do this. And the family, they become even more and more important because they really do care. They're not a number to the family.
Yeah.
So the family suffered along with them in trying to see their loved one come back, to normalcy. And they suffer, I wouldn't say as much, but they pretty close. I mean, because,
well,
when you know someone so well and love them and they seem fine and stable and then they come back and they're not anymore, that hurts.
Yeah.
You know, it probably maybe hurts them more because they're more conscious of it.
Well, a husband leaves for war and he returns a different person and their life is not the same.
No.
And
never
that's,
will be.
Yeah, and they've got to be bitter for that. I mean, they can't be too happy about that at all.
No, I mean, I think that's probably true in the long run, perhaps, if it continues in that way. But I think in the short run, they're just trying to kind of help them, especially if they're back.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm just agreeing with you.
They're just trying to help, you know, but in the long run, if they kind of are still, they stay in this sort of stagnant state, they do. They also reevaluate what they thought the battle was for, and a lot of them don't think it was worth it.
Yeah. Well, Mark, we have about only 1 minute left. Would you like to tell our audience something about, you know, where they can find your book, if you have
a
website,
yeah.
and then we can sign off.
Sure. You can get my book, Story of the Sand, at Amazon.com. Or you can go to my website, storyofthesand.com.
Okay, very good. Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for being our guest this
evening. Well, thank you, Joe.
Appreciate it, and I wish you all the luck in the world. I think it's a
although
it's a novel, I think it's a public service as well, and I appreciate that very much.
Well, I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you very much, and good night to you.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Wow, that's interesting. That is very, 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 very interesting, folks. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com.
Remember, you are either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. And remember, don't steal. The government hates competition. Until next time, and that'll be Wednesday evening, by the way. We'll not have a broadcast on Thursday morning, rather. It'll be Wednesday morning rather than Thursday morning. And then we'll have our regular broadcast on Sunday evening again. So until Wednesday morning at 6:30 a.m., stay well. Stay tuned.